The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenzo. Tongshan's Teachings of the Ascension, the main case. Dongshan studied with Yunyan, and he asked Yunyan, who can hear the teachings of the Ascension? Yunyan said, it can be heard by the Ascension. And Dongshan said, do you hear it, Master? Yunyan said, if I heard it, then you wouldn't hear my teaching. Dongshan said, well, that being the case, then I don't hear your teaching. Yunyan replied, you don't even hear my teaching. How could you hear the teaching of the insentient? Dongshan was enlightened on hearing this and wrote a verse. Wondrous, marvelous, the teachings of the insentient are inconceivable. If you listen with the ears, you won't understand. When you hear with the eyes, then you'll know. Dada Roshi's commentary. The 10,000 things are neither sentient nor insentient. The self is neither sentient nor insentient. Therefore, the teaching of the insentient cannot be perceived by the senses. This teaching is heard before there's a body and after mind is forgotten. It was heard before our parents were born and before the Buddha appeared. It is not a matter of ordinary consciousness. How then can it be heard? When body and mind have fallen away in the stillness that follows, the teaching is intimately manifested in great profusion. Whether we are aware of it or not, it is always taking place. This verse. The teaching of the insentient, if you try to grasp it, you'll miss it. It has no form. If you try to let it go, you cannot separate from it. It's not formless. Subtle and wondrously inconceivable, the muse constantly reveals the mysterious teachings of the 10,000 things. This is a favorite teaching of Dada Roshi's. He often spoke of this and the muse. I was looking through a collection of koans that he began to put together. It was never published. It was never really completed. He called it the Way of Reality koans. Doshinji, the temple name, is Way of Reality. And it was different koans drawn from different sources. There was one koan drawn from Alice Through the Looking Glass and other great works. And in there I found this a koan in which a monk was traveling and met a teacher who was in the lineage of Guishan. And she was running a convent. And he encountered her and he said, do you have any ancestors? She said, yes, I do. And the monk said, well, where are they? And the teacher said, they're right here. Plants, trees, mountains, rivers, the great earth itself are all my ancestors. We are surrounded by our ancestors, by those indigenous who lived here for thousands and thousands of years, the Munsee, the Lenape, and those of the waters that are never still, that we now call the Hudson. When we receive our Chikai, we very sort of explicitly make bows to the Buddha, to our parents, to our teacher, these lineage streams of ancestors. Every morning, every day when we do service, we invoke in a daily service a very condensed version of both our lineage and the list of women ancestors. On Sundays when we do the Amichiku, we dedicate its merits to the ancestors of the mountains and rivers, or to Sangha, us, and everyone who practices here. I remember when I first started coming here, chanting the ancestors on Sunday and hearing those names, it didn't really connect with me. My family has not does not have a strong sense of lineage in that way, but I remember a student who was European and came from a long line in Europe. And I was talking to her about it sometime later, and she said the first time she heard that, she felt so at home, like she knew exactly what that was about, because it was so much a part of her own life, that sense of ancestry. We're the descendants of innumerable beings. We are dependent upon them. We carry their DNA, their histories, mannerisms and habits of our family, ancestors, and beyond. Blindnesses as well as wisdoms, the results of past actions that we have inherited. Some are quite excellent, some are not excellent at all. We share in this earth, in the elements, in the warmth of the sun, the coolness of water, in beauty, music, art, dance. We share in the earth and everything of it. We share in our responsibility. We share in sickness, old age, and death with every living thing. You know, I often think when I'm reflecting on death, that in death, you know, we're just following a long, long line, right? And well, you're in very good company. Well, you're in all kinds of company, actually. But it's not the first time. And in the midst of all of that, that if we call it an abundance of ancestry, of ancestors, of living beings, animate and inanimate, that we cannot live without, we would not be here without, this false narrative in this country of the Lone Ranger, the one who got there, you got here by yourself. You pulled yourself up by your bootstraps. You did it. Of course, there's always some truth, but it's so incomplete, so dangerously incomplete. Because in that, who are we beholden to? Who are we obligated to? To whom do we owe our debts of gratitude? And you have nothing to pass on, if that's the way it goes. And so in the midst of all of that abundance, our self-clinging, our false views, our afflictive emotions, the grasping skandhas, all serve to be used by our mind to make us feel as though we're a kind of orphan of the universe, abandoned, alienated, cut off, distant, with no essential place, purpose, value other than what we can produce and sell or, I don't know, put online for 30 seconds or something. What an impoverishment. What a profound impoverishment. No wonder we're a very affluent, I mean, you know, for those who are in this country, and a very, very sad. A sad people, an unhappy people. A spiritually wanting people. And all the while, as Dogen says, Buddha's true Dharma body, your true Dharma body is like the open sky. The open sky is the as it is of the Buddha's true Dharma body. And because it is Buddha's true Dharma body, this entire earth, the entire universe, all phenomena, all appearances, anything and everything you could conceive of or perceive. Our open sky, same nature, same ancestry, same family. Hundreds of grasses, myriad forms, each appearing as it is. Thank goodness for that diversity. Are nothing but Buddha's true Dharma body, thusness of the moon and water. And so while we may feel, we may experience ourselves to be alone, alienated, disoriented, unnatural, in a natural world, like it's kind of extraordinary, what a symptom, what a sign that we could, particularly when we're in the midst of the unhuman-made world, that we could feel like we don't belong there. Right? And I understand the feeling that comes from, you know, that we've sort of mucked things up so much that sort of we don't deserve the right, but it's just not true. Yeah, we've mucked things up, but if we don't belong here, there, where do we belong? What does that even mean? That sense of, all of that sense of alienation, everything that we call delusion is really just a display, a demonstration of the power of our mind to create a world that for us is a real world. It's not a true world, but it's a real world to us. We experience it, we respond to it, we dream it. It dreams us. But think about moments I would imagine all of us have had. Some people call it grace or bliss or wonder or peace, something inexplicable, inexpressible, but inarguable, that you have experienced where all of that distance and fracture drops away and there is a certainty, a knowing in that moment, in that place, within your person, that there is a kind of rightness of the whole world, of everything in that moment. Everything wrong, everything false, everything, all of that drops away, and there's just a complete moment. It might be in the mountains, by a riverside, by the ocean, under the sky, a sunset or a sunrise, the moon, might be listening to a piece of music, dancing or experiencing dance. It might be holding a baby. I hope we have had many such experiences in many different places here in this hall. In the shadow of this mountain, all the years I spent in Brooklyn, there were many moments where I felt that on the subway, walking down the street, that within all of that noise and bustle and wildness, that there were moments that were sacred, where all of that became sacralized somehow. All of the breaking apart, broke apart. What is that, actually? What is going on? You can't create it. My early years, because most of those experiences came in the woods, oftentimes when I went into the woods, which was often, I would go to have such an experience, right? Okay. I'm here, let it happen. Of course, not that way. But what is being touched? Because something is being experienced intimately. There's some, as Dogen might speak of it, an intimate and subtle communication. We are in communication with something. It is not just us, but we are in the presence of something. We may not even know. A contact between us and our relations. There's so many ways in which we can think about that and appreciate that in terms of the sciences, in terms of the arts, in terms of philosophy. But this is something more. And to really consider and appreciate the profound implication of Mahayana Buddhism's emphasis on our practice and study and realization of the true nature of all things, sentient and insentient. That's why this is such an important dialogue. It's kind of a, in a way, in the Zen tradition, and there are other such teachings, but it, to me, it's kind of a foundational teaching for Buddha Dharma that is expressing this basic truth explicitly. Explicitly about that common ancestry, about what we actually are. And that it's not limited to us. You know, I mean, as human beings, we empower what we see in kind, right? I remember talking to a student years ago who said if she could only meet someone just like her, she would marry that person in a moment. I thought, wow, you said that. Okay. And I thought, but how would it actually go? But when we see something we don't recognize, an appearance, a voice, a language, a background, a form, then it so quickly becomes other. It so quickly becomes less. Right? So the sense that if other creatures, other complex living beings can't crack a code or play a game like we do, then they don't have intelligence. Right? If they can't learn to speak our language, then they don't have language. Maybe a little arrogant. Dogen says, because it is open sky, it is your true Dharma body. The entire earth, the entire universe, all phenomena, every appearance is like this. If that's so, with that kind of ubiquitousness, if it's just all over the place, then why don't we know it? Why don't we see it? Why isn't it obvious to us? Well, Dada Roshi says, it's something that was born before our parents, before the Buddha appeared. It's not a matter of ordinary consciousness. That's why the Buddha, by his own words, hesitated to teach. He understood what was the task before him. How was he going to teach and point to and bring us to something that was inaccessible, in a sense, by every one of those actions? I mean, it's extraordinary that he went ahead. And this is just a section of the dialogue. The full dialogue is in the record of Master Dongshan, who's an important teacher in our lineage, in which he came to Yunyan, or originally to Kweishan, another teacher, and was asking about a teaching he'd heard with the national teacher of China at that time. And he wanted to ask him about it. And so the teacher said, well, tell me, what was the teaching? And so Dongshan said, well, a student came to Master Huichung, the national teacher, and said, what sort of thing is the mind of ancient Buddhas? What is Buddha mind? And the national teacher said, it's wall and tile rubble. And the student said, isn't that something insentient? And the national teacher said, yeah, it is. And the student says, and yet it can expound the Dharma? And the Kweshan said, it's constantly, or the national teacher said, it's constantly expounding it, radiantly expounding it, without ceasing. Then the student says, then why haven't I heard it, right? I mean, that's a reasonable question. If it's ceaselessly being expounded, why haven't I heard it? I'm surrounded by all of these insentient things. And the natural teacher said, you yourself haven't heard it, but that doesn't hinder those who are able to hear it. And I think that's such an important point. That oftentimes when we can't hear something or see something, particularly if it's challenging, we may just decide there's nothing there. Not of interest, not of value, not worth my time, simply because we can't hear it or see it. And the student went on to say, well, what sort of person can hear this? And the national teacher said, well, all of the sages have acquired such hearing, have gained the ability to hear the teachings of the insentient. And then the student says, well, can you hear it? And the national teacher says, no, I can't. And the student says, well, if you haven't heard it, then how do you know that non-sentient beings expound the Dharma? And the national teacher said, it's good for you that I haven't heard it. If I had, I would be the same as the sages, and you wouldn't hear the Dharma that I teach. And the student says, well, in that case, an ordinary people have no part of it. In other words, this is something in a completely different realm that has nothing to do with me or any other person. And the national teacher said, I only teach for ordinary people. The student says, well, what happens when ordinary people hear this teaching? And the teacher said, then they're no longer ordinary people. And then he goes on to ask about, does this come from a sutra? And they have a discussion. And he ends up sending him to another teacher, in this case, Yunyan, from which the koan is taken. And he brings the same question, brings the dialogue, same question. And Yunyan says, non-sentient beings can hear this teaching. And then he asks again, can you hear it? And he says, if I could hear it, you wouldn't be able to hear my teaching. Same response. And Dongsha says, well, why can't I hear it? And Yunyan held up his kutz and says, can you hear this? And Dongsha says, no, I can't. And Yunyan says, well, you can't even hear this when I expound the Dharma. How could you hear the teaching of the insentient? Then he says, what sutra is this taught? And Yunyan says, it's in the Amitabha Sutra. It says, water birds, tree groves, all without exception recite the Buddha's name, recite the Dharma. And at this, Dongshan gained realization and said, how amazing, or wondrous, marvelous. The teachings of the insentient are inconceivable. If you listen with the ears, you won't understand. When you hear with the eyes, then you'll know. So who can hear the teaching of the insentient? It's in not hearing this that we find our estrangement. Yunyan said, it can't be heard by the insentient, or it can only be heard by the insentient. Only a Buddha can encounter Buddha, only Kanon Bodhisattva can encounter Kanon Bodhisattva. To meet the mountain, you have to be the mountain yourself. To realize the open sky, your very mind must be open sky. Given that these are always true, all we need to do is stop creating, stop producing for one moment, for one instant, the idea that it's not so. But we're just a person, right? If you're just a person, a self, you have a name, you have a history, memories. If that's who you are, then how can you be Buddha? How can you be Kanon? How can you be a mountain? How can you be anything else? How can you be anything more? How can you be no thing at all? Well, you can't. You can no more be no self than you can be a self. It's not in the field of being and non-being. It's not of that realm. Anything you point to, with anything you use to point, from any place upon which you're standing, as the person pointing, with any intention in pointing, all of these are originally liberated. They're all free of ordinary consciousness and function completely within ordinary consciousness. All are liberated from that alienation, that isolation, that independent existence. All are free of entanglements, are free of separation. And I think in those moments of bliss or wonder or grace, whatever name we want to give to it, we're being touched, we're touching that. It's not realized, it's not understood. It's transformative in that moment. Maybe it lingers. Maybe it opens the door to the sense that there is something more. There has to be something more. If we sit down and try and figure that out, what was that about? Analyze it. Quantify it. Hopefully we'll meet the end of that quickly enough and give that up and realize, no, this is something else. Can we not know? Can we allow that? Can we not know? And know that that experience is true. Because you already do. And so this teaching of Buddha nature, of fundamental, original, complete nature, the moon, is so essential, right? Because we have to hear that, we have to hear that, we have to hear that, we have to cultivate faith in that, and then we have to practice in accord with it. And when we don't, you'll know, because it's going to be a struggle. The signs are pretty clear. Where there's smoke, there's fire. Read the signs. Trace them back. Right? Don't get entangled in the smoke. Trace them back. What am I holding on to? What am I in conflict with? What am I wanting that I'm not getting? What am I believing that's not true? What am I not believing that is true? But how do we hear these teachings when Dongshan said, if you listen with your ears, you won't understand. When you hear with your eyes, then you'll know. What kind of madness is that? What kind of crazy talk is that? How do you practice that? Well, in the fascicle, Dogen recites the dialogue by Tozzi, who was once asked by a student, when the moon is not yet full, what then? When it's not yet full. When it's not yet revealing itself. When practice is not yet realization. When realization is not yet enlightenment. What then? The master said, swallow three or four. And so Dada Roshi says, how can it be heard when the body and mind have fallen away in the stillness, the samadhi that follows, that this teaching is intimately manifested in great profusion. Whether we're aware of it or not, this is always taking place. Before there is a body, and after mind is forgotten, to see the face, your face before your parents were born, to realize the Dharma before the Buddha appeared, swallow three or four. When we are practice being the breath, and you let go of everything, of all of the ordinary consciousness into the breath, we call that samadhi. when you swallow the breath, when the breath swallows you, that we call realization. It's all-inclusive, it's undivided, it's what Dogen calls the mind moon. A student once asked Master Zhaozhou, what is the true Dharma? And Zhaozhou said, the oak tree in the garden. He was inviting that student to swallow the oak tree, which is the same as being swallowed by the oak tree. But what does that mean? If you're you, you're a person. The oak tree is a tree. Come on. So we have to loosen our grip. Those moments that we cannot explain are telling us there are things that cannot be explained. They are true. They surround us. They are known. There are those who hear these teachings. There are practices that guide them to us, guide us to them, and them to us. When we're distracted, when we cling to our thoughts, emotions, histories, of course, what we experience is the divided mind, the disenfranchised self, lonely, alienated. If we try to just get past that, because that's pretty uncomfortable, we will still not experience the undivided because we're just dividing ourselves in a different way. That's what the Buddha said, aversion, denying, suppressing, ignoring, that's one way. Grasping, attaching, clinging, that's another way. They're both really just the same. Two versions of one action. And so that's why we have to stop and stop more and experience that stillness, which is not the word stillness. And that's why it is important in this Zendo when we're practicing, but whenever you're practicing, to trust the importance of that. It's not a rule, it's not a discipline, although sometimes we need to practice within the discipline because we're wiggly and we're restless and we want to get away. I mean, it's not that complicated. We just want to get the hell away, right? And to actually voluntarily, freely hold ourselves with an open hand, not a tight fist, an open hand, and say, yes, I see you, restless one, and I'm not moving. I'm right here. And you are one of my ancestors, friend. So get used to that. Get used to not moving, because we're not moving. And so even the subtle movements, you know, the subtle movements, the inner, you know, indiscernible, right? Practice is not something to try and get away with. You know, can I get away with this? Like, for who? For what? But we do need to trust that, right? Because in the moment of wanting to get away, that just seems, that's very compelling. And that often seems like really the right thing to do. And it always, always has a reason. Mara is very rational. Always comes fully loaded with all kinds of rationales and reasons. And anything you're going to throw out, there's a backup. Right? Hey, you haven't thought about this. You haven't thought about this. And so really we have to, there's that image of the black lacquer bucket, which sometimes is delusion, that we have to just empty that out. Tire Mara out. Dongshan said, do you hear it, Master? And Yunyan said, if I heard it, then you would not hear my teaching. What happens in the moment of hearing it? He says, you cease to become an ordinary being, which could be very easily misunderstood. You become something better. Power. Right? No. Dada Roshi once told the story of coming in when he was preparing a group of students to receive Jikai. He was coming in to give the day's talk, and he overheard one of them talking about looking forward to getting Jikai in the Rock Sutta, because then, you know, they'd be sort of have more, you know, street cred, have more, you know, authority. And Arushi walked in and said, "Wrong." He said, "You are becoming a servant of the people. That's what this is." At that time of hearing the insentient, there's no one who can be heard, no one who can be seen. The family reunion is complete, and there's no head count. All one great ocean, like the ocean, right? Which we understand is just a bunch of drops, but it's not. And we might think, well, what good is that? All of that letting go. All of that no self. Well, it's not for any good. It's got no use. It's no point. There's no reward, no punishment, no attainment, no becoming better, no becoming bigger. It's freeing of all of that. You don't have to become anymore. You don't have to be. You don't have to prove that you deserve to be in this family. Thanissara, in the passages of the book Time to Stand Up that we're reading, she said, "Enlightened wisdom as a revered attribute is represented through the feminine archetype of Prajnaparamita." Prajnaparamita is sitting on the Buddha's right hand here. Prajnaparamita is the great wisdom of the other shore. It's the wisdom that infuses, that makes all the other paramitas wisdom practices. Thanissara says, she's the one who ever dwells in the perfection of prajna, life and love-giving, nourishing wisdom. Prajna, translated as wisdom, really means before knowing. That's what it literally means, before knowing. Hearing with the eyes, seeing with the ears, not with ordinary consciousness. Before we objectify and label and name this manifested world, what is the true nature of things is deeply known in the heart of the womb of awareness. And known here is not in the ordinary sense. Even to say encountered or met or realized. Realization is where something that is unrealizable, because that requires subject and object, is experienced directly without knowing. And then there's an emerging. Dada Roshi once described it as though we're emerging, right? From, it's almost like coming from the deep, deep moonless night, dark, and then there's the first hint of light, where nothing is yet really clear and distinct, but there's a kind of light that we look back and we see something. It's like a liminal. And that's just a way of talking. It's just a way of trying to describe something that's indescribable. It is known and loved as most intimate and most precious, Prajnaparamita. It's a body of wisdom. And she's talking about the text, the Diamond Sutra, the Heart Sutra, the Sutra of 8,000 Lines, this amazing body of teachings that is part of our inheritance, part of our ancestry, which is speaking about this great wisdom, this life and love-giving wisdom. And she says those teachings address the mystery of consciousness that is personified as the mother of all Buddhas. Prajnaparamita is the mother of all Buddhas, because all Buddhas are born from her, from this. From her formless, loving, undivided, intuitively intelligent womb of awareness, wisdom is born. She says, without this more mysterious dimension of primordial knowing, this womb of awareness that spontaneously gives birth to wisdom, there would be no Buddha. There would be no Buddha. When we understand this, we have profound reverence for the sacred feminine, because it is the root of all our potentiality within the manifested world. Life-giving, love, compassion-giving, all-inclusive giving. It's the impartiality of the heart of the Bodhisattva, loving all beings equally, which is a great practice, great as in large, great as in challenging. Because as long as we have aspects of self, as we still have our history and personality, which doesn't go away, we're going to feel attractions, inclinations, movements towards, movements away. And so to cultivate that impartiality, right, towards all things. Because then all things are seen as they are, and all things become worthy, revered. So we have to enter into that mystery. That's why we spend this week, every month, sitting deeply. That's why this kind of practice exists in every practice meditation-based tradition of Buddhism, in some form or fashion, in complement to the everyday practice that we all do. And just to appreciate that, like this is part of what we've inherited, this ancient understanding that both of those are essential. There's everyday practicing and living to keep our house in order and to learn how to practice every day, in every day. And then to turn into this, to create such an environment, an atmosphere as this, to be able to dedicate so utterly. Because in that, things are experienced and seen that become memories, but in your being are not forgotten. And that's really important, right? We don't need to hold on to our memories. You never want to try and it's good not to try and recreate them. That doesn't mean we don't try, but we can't, right? No one ever goes back. But we don't need to, because the most important part of any genuine experience that is of this mind moon is in you now. When we don't hear the teachings of the ascension, the world beyond ourselves can seem dead and inert and uninteresting. Maybe that's why we have to keep turning up the volume, right? And having more and more. And now let's create worlds that don't even exist and live in them. What kind of dangerous is this? I think that has the power to become a temptation that will, for people who grow up in it, will be almost impossible to resist. I remember years ago when, social media and internet and cell phones and all this stuff was just, I was talking to a student who was talking about her daughter who was struggling with all of this, and she was describing all the ways that she was getting hooked. And I thought, oh my God, that is just way too much power for a teenager to have. I would have never been able to manage that. When we don't have such moments that reveal to us, like peel back the curtain a bit and show us there is more. Right here, right now, in the most unexpected of places. Of course we expect it in the mountains and in beautiful places. But as Dongshan said, it's ceaselessly expounded, radiantly. And so we stop and turn the light around and look deeply and make contact and make contact and make contact and give up trying to describe and explain and compare so that contact can be more clear and true and pervasive. It's not competing with our projections. It's not competing with our ideas. It doesn't have to struggle with making sense. It doesn't have to make sense. Although it does, utterly, when we let go of the ordinary ways we have. And that's why we're sitting in a zendo and not a classroom. That's why you're sitting on a diamond seat, right? Without a book in front of you. You're the sutra. You are the sutra. We only have to learn how to not even read it, but just hear it being expounded. Dogen says in Genjo Koan, though there are many aspects of the secular life and the religious life, we only recognize and understand what the power of our penetrating vision can reach, will show us, will allow us to see. That's so important. Because all it means is when we encounter something, we hear something, a teaching, something that does we don't yet understand, that's all that means. That the extent of our of vision, of our ability to see, is just not yet reaching there. That's all. Not yet. In order to appreciate the 10,000 dharmas, we should know that although they may look round or square, they appear in all different forms, the other qualities of oceans and mountains are infinite in variety. There are other universes that lie in all quarters as worlds upon worlds and worlds within worlds. And Dogen says, it is not so only around ourselves, but also directly here, even in a drop of water. And so that's one reason we pay attention to this, what's right in front of us, and recognize the wondrous nature within what we call simplicity, which is containing worlds. For those who stop and look and hear with the eyes. And so let's practice this session all the way through. You know, let's not be fooled by the idea of beginning and ending, turning it on, turning it off. Close to the end, let's think about tomorrow, let's think about next week, let's start planning. You know, if you find yourself falling into that, which is easy because we're so conditioned to do that, just remember, wait a minute, what have I devoted this whole week to? Right here. Like this great female teacher said, the story I started with, right here, you are in the midst of all of your ancestors. Don't turn your back. We are being invited in. And when we open our door, we realize that. Oh, I was always here. Always welcome.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.